Chapter 21. Dusk fell, almost surreptitiously, with a cold breeze and a mantle of purple light that slid between the gaps in the streets. I quickened my pace, and 20 minutes later the front of the university emerged like an ochre ship anchored in the night. In his lodge, the porter of the literature department perused the words of the nation's most influential bylines in the afternoon edition of the sports pages. There seemed to be hardly any students left in the premises. The echo of my footsteps followed me through the corridors and galleries that led to the cloister, where the glow of 2 yellowish lights barely disturbed the shadows. It suddenly occurred to me that perhaps Bea had tricked me, that she'd arranged to meet me there at that untimely hour as some sort of revenge. The leaves on the orange trees in the cloister shimmered like silver tears, and the sound of the fountain echoed through the arches. I looked carefully around the courtyard, contemplating disappointment, or maybe a certain cowardly sense of relief. There she was, sitting on one of the benches, her silhouette outlined against the fountain, her eyes looking up towards the vaults of the cloister. I stopped at the entrance to gaze at her, and for a moment I was reminded of Nuria Montfort daydreaming on her bench in the square. I noticed she didn't have her folder or her books with her, and I suspected she hadn't had any classes that afternoon. Perhaps she'd come here just to meet me. I swallowed hard and walked into the cloister. The sound of my footsteps gave me away, and Bea looked up, with a smile of surprise, as if my presence there were just a coincidence.
"I thought you weren't coming," said Bea.
"That's just what I thought," I replied. She remained seated, upright, her knees tight together and her hands on her lap. I asked myself how I could feel so detached from her and at the same time read every little detail of her lips.
"I've come because I want to prove to you that you were wrong about what you said the other day, Daniel. I'm going to marry Pablo, and I don't care what you show me tonight. I'm going to El Ferrol as soon as he's finished his military service."
I looked at her as if I'd just had the rug pulled out from under my feet. I realised I'd spent 2 days walking on air and now my whole world was collapsing.
"And there I was thinking you'd come because you felt like seeing me,"
I managed a weak smile. I noticed her blushing self-consciously.
"I was only joking," I lied. "What I was serious about was my promise to show you a face of the city that you don't yet know.
At least that will give you a cause to remember me, or Barcelona, whenever you go." There was a touch of sadness in Bea's smile, and she avoided my eyes.
"I nearly went to the cinema, you know, so as not to see you today," she said.
"Why?" Bea looked at me but said nothing. She shrugged her shoulders and raised her eyes, as if she were trying to catch words that were escaping from her.
"Because I was afraid that perhaps you were right," she said at last.
I sighed. We were shielded by the evening light and that despondent silence that brings strangers together, and I felt brave enough to say anything that came into my head, even though it might be for the last time.
"Do you love him, or don't you?"
A smile came and went.
"It's none of your business."
"That's true," I said. "It's only your business." She gave me a cold look.
"And what does it matter to you?"
"It's none of your business," I said. She didn't smile. Her lips trembled.
"People who know me know I'm very fond of Pablo. My family and..."
"But I'm also a stranger," I interrupted, "and I would like to hear it from you."
"Hear what?"
"That you really love him. That you're not marrying him to get away from home, to put distance between yourself and Barcelona and your family. To go somewhere where they can't hurt you. That you're leaving and not running away." Her eyes shone with angry tears.
"You have no right to say that to me, Daniel. You don't know me."
"Tell me I'm mistaken and I'll leave.
Do you love him?"
We looked at one another for a long while without saying a word.
"I don't know," she murmured at last. "I don't know." Someone once said that the moment you stop to think about whether you love someone, you've already stopped loving that person forever, I said. Bear looked for the irony in my expression. Who said that? Someone called Julian Carax. A friend of yours? I caught myself nodding. Sort of. You're going to have to introduce him to me. Tonight, if you like. We left the university under a bruised sky and wandered aimlessly, just getting used to walking side by side. We took shelter in the only subject we had in common, her brother, Tomas. Bea spoke about him as if he were a virtual stranger, someone she loved but barely knew. She avoided my eyes and smiled nervously. I felt that she regretted what she had said to me in the university cloister, that the words still hurt and were still gnawing at her. Listen, what I said to you before, she said suddenly, you won't mention a word to Tomas, will you? Of course not. I won't tell anyone. She laughed nervously. I don't know what came over me. Don't be offended, but sometimes it's easier to talk to a stranger than someone you know. Why is that? I shrugged. Probably because a stranger sees us the way we are, not as they wish us to be. Is that also from your friend Carax? No, I just made it up to impress you. And how do you see me? As a mystery? That's the strangest compliment anyone has ever paid me. It's not a compliment, it's a threat. What do you mean? Mysteries must be solved. One must find out what they hide. You might be disappointed when you see what's inside. I might be surprised, and you too. Tomas never told me you had so much cheek. That's because what little I have, I've reserved entirely for you. Why? Because I'm afraid of you, I thought. We sought refuge in a small cafe next to the Poliorama Theatre. Withdrawing to a table by the window, we asked for some Serrano ham sandwiches and a couple of white coffees to warm up. Soon thereafter, the manager, a scrawny fellow with the face of an imp, came up to the table with an attentive expression. Did you folks ask for the ham sandwiches? We nodded. Sorry, we have to announce on behalf of the management here that there's not a scrap of ham left. I can offer black and white or mixed butifarra, meatballs or chistorra, top of the line, extra fresh. I also have pickled sardines if you folks can't consume meat products for reasons of religious conscience. It's been Friday.
I'll be fine with a white coffee, really, said Bea.
I was starving.
What if you bring 2 servings of spicy potatoes and some bread, too?
Right away, sir, and please pardon the shortness of supplies. Usually I tend to have everything, even Bolshevik caviar. But this afternoon, it's been the European Cup semi-final. We've had a lot of customers. Oh, great game.
The manager walked away ceremoniously. Bayer watched him with amusement.
Where's that accent from?
Jaén? Much closer, Santa Coloma de Gramanet, I specified. You don't often take the subway, do you?
My father says the subway is full of riffraff, and that if you're on your own, the gypsies feel you up. I was about to say something, but decided to keep my mouth shut.
Bea laughed. As soon as the coffees and the food arrived, I fell on it all with no pretense at refinement. Bea didn't eat anything. With her hand spread around the steaming cup, she watched me with half a smile, caught somewhere between curiosity and amazement.
So, what is it you're going to show me today?
A number of things. In fact, what I'm going to show you is part of a story.
Didn't you tell me the other day that what you like to do is read?
Bea nodded, arching her eyebrows. Well, this is a story about books.
About books?
About accursed books. About the man who wrote them. About a character who broke out of the pages of a novel so that he could burn it. About a betrayal and a lost friendship. It's a story of love, of hatred, and of the dreams that live in the shadow of the wind.
You sound like the jacket blurb of a Victorian novel, Daniel.
That's probably because I work in a bookshop, and I've seen too many. But this is a true story, as real as the fact that this bread they served us is at least 3 days old. And like all true stories, it begins and ends in a cemetery, although not the sort of cemetery you imagine. She smiled the way children smile when they've been promised a riddle or a magic trick. I'm all ears. I gulped down the last of my coffee and looked at her for a few moments without saying anything. I thought about how much I wanted to lose myself in those evasive eyes. I thought about the loneliness that would take hold of me that night when I said goodbye to her, once I'd run out of tricks or stories to make her stay with me any longer. I thought about how little I had to offer her and how much I wanted from her. I can hear your brains clanking, Daniel. What are you planning? I began my story with that distant dawn when I awoke and could not remember my mother's face. And I didn't stop until I paused to recall the world of shadows I had sensed that very morning in the home of Nuria Montfort. Bea listened quietly, making no judgment, drawing no conclusions. I told her about my first visit to the cemetery of forgotten books, and about the night I spent reading The Shadow of the Wind. I told her about my meeting with the faceless man, and about the letter signed by Penelope Aldaya that I always carried with me without knowing why. I spoke about how I had never kissed Clara Barthelot, or anyone, and of how my hands had trembled when I felt the touch of Nuria Montfort's lips on my skin, only a few hours before. I told her how, until that moment, I had not understood that this was a story about lonely people, about absence and loss, and that that was why I had taken refuge in it until it became confused with my own life, like someone who has escaped into the pages of a novel because those whom he needs to love seem nothing more than ghosts inhabiting the mind of a stranger. Don't say anything, whispered Bea. Just take me to that place. It was pitch dark when we stopped by the front door of the Cemetery of Forgotten Books, in the gloom of Calle Arco de Teatro. I lifted the devil head knocker and knocked 3 times. While we waited, sheltering under the arch of the entrance, the cold wind smelled of charcoal. I met Bea's eyes so close to mine. She was smiling. Soon we heard light footsteps approaching the door, and then the tired voice of the keeper.
Who's there? Asked Isaac.
It's Daniel Sempere, Isaac.
I thought I could hear him swearing under his breath. There followed the 1,000 squeaks and groans from the intricate system of locks. Finally, the door yielded an inch or two, revealing the vulturine face of Isaac Montfort, lit by candlelight. When he saw me, the keeper sighed and rolled his eyes.
Stupid of me. I don't know why I ask, he said. Who else could it be at this time of night?
Isaac was clothed in what seemed like a strange crossbreed of dressing gown, bathrobe and Russian army coat. The padded slippers perfectly matched a checked wool cap, rather like a professor's cap, complete with tassel. I hope I didn't get you out of bed, I said.
Not at all. I'd only just started saying my prayers.
He looked at Bea as if he'd just seen a pack of dynamite sticks alight at his feet.
For your own good, I hope this isn't what it looks like, he threatened.
Isaac, this is my friend Beatrice, and with your permission, I'd like to show her this place. Don't worry, she's completely trustworthy.
Sempere, I've known toddlers with more common sense than you.
It would only be for a moment.
Isaac let out a snort of defeat and examined Bea carefully, like a suspicious policeman.
Do you realise you're in the company of an idiot? He asked.
Bea smiled politely.
I'm beginning to come to terms with it.
Sublime innocence. You know the rules?
Bea nodded. Isaac mumbled under his breath and let us in, scanning the shadows of the street as usual.
I visited your daughter, Nuria, I mentioned casually. She's well, working hard, but well. She sends you her love?
Yes, and poisoned darts. You're not much good at making things up, Sempere, but but I appreciate the effort. Come on in.
Once inside, Isaac handed me the candle and proceeded to lock the door.
When you've finished, you know where to find me.
Under the mantle of darkness, we could only just make out the spectral forms of the book maze. The candle projected its bubble of light at our feet. Bea paused, astonished, at the entrance to the labyrinth. I smiled, recognizing in her face the same expression my father must have seen in mine years before. We entered the tunnels and galleries of the maze. They creaked under our footsteps. The marks I had made during my last incursion were still there.
Come on, I want to show you something, I said.
More than once I lost my own trail, and we had to go backwards in search of the last sign. Bea watched me with a mixture of alarm and fascination. My inner compass told me we were caught in a knot of spirals that rose slowly towards the very heart of the labyrinth. At last I managed to retrace my steps through the tangle of corridors and tunnels until I entered a narrow passage that felt like a gangway stretching out into the gloom. I knelt down by the last shelf and looked for my old friend hidden behind the row of dust-coloured volumes, a layer of dust shining like frost in the candlelight. I took the book and handed it to Bea.
Let me introduce you to Julian Carax.
The Shadow of the Wind, Bea read, stroking the faded letters on the cover. Can I take it with me? She asked.
You can take any book, but this one.
But that's not fair. After all the things you've told me, this is precisely the one I want.
One day perhaps, but not today. I took it from her and put it back in its hiding place.
I'll come back without you, and I'll take it away without you knowing, she said mockingly.
You wouldn't find it in 1,000 years.
That's what you think. I've seen your notches, and I too know the story of the Minotaur.
Isaac wouldn't let you in.
You're wrong. He prefers me to you.
And how do you know?
I can read people's eyes.
Despite myself, I believed her and turned mine away.
Choose any other one. Here, this one looks promising. The Castilian Hog, That Unknown Beast, In Search of the Roots of Iberian Pork by Anselmo Torquemada. I'm sure it sold more copies than any book by Julian Carax. Every part of the pig can be put to good use.
I'm more attracted to this other one.
Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
It's the original.
You're bold enough to read Hardy in English.
She gave me a sidelong glance.
All yours, then.
Don't you see? It feels as if it's been waiting for me. As if it has been hiding here for me, from before I was born.
I looked at her in astonishment. Bea's lips crinkled into a smile.
What have I said?
Then, without thinking, barely brushing her lips, I kissed her. It was almost midnight when we reached the front door of Bea's house. We had walked most of the way without speaking, not daring to turn our thoughts into words. We walked apart, hiding from one another. Bea walked upright with her Tess under her arm, and I followed a step behind, still tasting her lips. The way Isaac had glanced at me when we left the Cemetery of Forgotten Books was still on my mind. It was a look I knew well and had seen 1,000 times from my father, a look that asked me whether I had the slightest idea what I was doing. The last hours I'd been lost in another world, a universe of touches and looks I did not understand, and that blotted out both reason and shame. Now, back in the reality that always lies in wait among the shadows of the Ensanche Quarter, the enchantment was lifting, and all I had left was painful desire and an indescribable restlessness. And yet just looking at Bea was enough for me to realize that my doubts were a breeze compared to the storm that was raging inside her. We stopped by her door and looked at one another without attempting to pretend. A mellifluous night watchman was walking up to us unhurriedly, humming boleros to the rhythmic jingle of his bunch of keys.
Perhaps you'd rather we didn't see each other again, I suggested without much conviction.
I don't know, Daniel. I don't know anything. Is that what you want? No, of course not. And you?
She shrugged her shoulders and smiled faintly.
What do you think? She asked. I lied to you earlier, you know, in the cloister.
What about?
About not wanting to see you today.
The night porter hung about, smirking at us, obviously indifferent to my first whispered exchange at a front door. To him, experienced in such matters, it must have seemed a string of clichés and banalities.
Don't worry about me. There's no hurry, he said. I'll have a smoke on the corner, and you just let me know.
I waited for the watchman to walk away.
When will I see you again? I don't know, Daniel. Tomorrow? Please, Daniel, I don't know.
I nodded. She stroked my face.
You'd better leave now.
You know where to find me, at least. She nodded. I'll be waiting.
Me too.
As I moved away, I couldn't take my eyes off her. The night watchman, an expert in these situations, was already walking up to open the door for her.
You rascal, he whispered as he went by,
not without admiration.
What a looker.
I waited until Bayer had gone into the building and then set off briskly, turning to glance back at every step. Slowly I became possessed by the absurd conviction that anything was possible. And it seemed to me that even those deserted streets and that hostile wind smelled of hope. When I reached Plaza de Catalunya, I noticed that a flock of pigeons had congregated in the centre of the square, covering it with a blanket of white feathers that swayed silently. I thought of going round them, but at that moment I noticed that the pigeons were parting to let me pass, instead of flying off. I felt my way forward, as the pigeons broke ranks in front of me and reformed behind me. When I got to the middle of the square, I heard the peal of the cathedral bells ringing out midnight. I paused for a moment, stranded in an ocean of silvery birds, and thought how this had been the strangest and most marvellous day of my life.
Chapter 22. The light was still on in the bookshop when I crossed the street towards the shop window. I thought that perhaps my father had stayed on until late, getting up to date with his correspondence, or finding some other excuse to wait up for me and pump me for information about my meeting with Bayer. I could see a silhouette making a pile of books and recognised the gaunt, nervous profile of Fermin, lost in concentration. I rapped on the pane with my knuckles. Fermin looked out, pleasantly surprised, and signalled to me to pop in through the backroom door.
Still working, Fermin, it's terribly late. I'm really just killing time until I go over to poor Don Federico's to watch over him. I'm taking turns with Eloy from the opticians. I don't sleep much anyhow, 2 or 3 hours at the most. Mind you can't talk either, Daniel. It's past midnight, from which I infer that your meeting with a young lady was a roaring success.
I shrugged my shoulders.
The truth is, I don't know, I admitted. Did she let you feel her up?
No.
A good sign. Never trust girls who let themselves be touched right away, but even less those who need a priest for approval. Good sirloin steak, if you'll excuse the comparison, needs to be cooked until it's medium rare. Of course, if the opportunity arises, don't be prudish and go for the kill. But if what you're looking for is something serious, like this thing with me and Bernarda, remember the golden rule.
Is your thing serious?
More than serious, spiritual. And what about you and this pumpkin Beatrice? You can see a mile off that she's worth a million, but the crux of the matter is this. Is she the sort who makes you fall in love, or the sort who merely stirs your nether regions?
I haven't the slightest idea, I pointed out. Both things, I'd say.
Look, Daniel, this is like indigestion. Do you notice something here, in the mouth of the stomach, as if you'd swallowed a brick, or do you just feel a general feverishness?
The brick thing sounds more like it, I said, although I didn't altogether discard the fever.
That means it's a serious matter, God help us. Come on, sit down and I'll make you a lime blossom tea.
We settled down round the table in the back room, surrounded by books.
The city was asleep, and the bookshop felt like a boat adrift in a sea of silence and shadows. Fermin handed me a steaming hot cup and smiled at me a little awkwardly. Something was bothering him. "May I ask you a personal question, Daniel?"
"Of course."
"I beg you to answer in all frankness," he said, and he cleared his throat. "Do you think I could ever be a father?"
He must have seen my puzzled expression, and he quickly added,
"I don't mean biologically. I may look a bit rickety, but by good luck, Providence has endowed me with the potency and the fury of a fighting bull. I'm referring to the other sort of father. A good father, if you see what I mean."
"A good father?"
"Yes, like yours. A man with a head, a heart, and a soul. A man capable of listening, of leading and respecting a child, and not of drowning his own defects in him. Someone whom a child will not only love because he's his father, but will also admire for the person he is. Someone he would want to grow up to resemble."
"Why are you asking me this, Fermin? I thought you didn't believe in marriage and families. The yoke and all that, remember?"
Fermin nodded. "Look, all that's for amateurs. Marriage and family are only what we make of them. Without that, they're just a nest of hypocrisy, garbage and empty words. But if there is real love, the sort you don't go around telling everyone about, the sort that is felt and lived...
"You're a changed man, Fermin."
"I am. Bernarda has made me want to be a better man."
"How's that?"
"So that I can deserve her. You cannot understand such things right now because you're young. But in good time you'll see that sometimes what matters isn't what one gives, but what one gives up. Bernarda and I have been talking. She's quite a mother hen, as you know. She doesn't say so, but I think the one thing in life that will make her truly happy is to become a mother. And that woman is sweeter than peaches in syrup to me. Suffice to say that, for her, I'm prepared to enter a church after 32 years of clerical abstinence and recite the Psalms of St. Seraph or whatever needs to be done."
"Aren't you getting a bit ahead of yourself, Fermin? You've only just met her."
"Look, Daniel, at my age, either you begin to see things for what they are, or you're pretty much done for. Only three or four things are worth living for. The rest is shit. I've already fooled around a lot, and now I know that the only thing I really want is to make Bernarda happy and die one day in her arms. I want to be a respectable man again, see? Not for my sake. As far as I'm concerned, I couldn't give a fly's fart for the respect of this chorus of simians we call humanity, but for hers. Because Bernarda believes in such things, in radio soaps, in priests, in respectability, in Our Lady of Lourdes. That's the way she is. And I want her exactly like that. I even like those hairs that grow on her chin. And that's why I want to be someone she can be proud of. I want her to think, my Fermin is one hell of a man, like Cary Grant, Hemingway, or Manolete."
I crossed my arms, weighing up the situation. "Have you spoken about all this with her? About having a child together?"
"Goodness, no. What do you take me for? Do you think I'd go around telling women I want to get them knocked up? And it's not that I don't feel like it. Take that silly Methodetus. I'd put some triplets in her right now and feel on top of the world, but..."
"Have you told Bernarda you'd like to have a family?"
"These things don't need to be said, Daniel. They show on your face."
I nodded. "Well then, for what my opinion is worth, I'm sure you'll be an excellent father and husband. And since you don't believe in those things, you'll never take them for granted." His face melted into happiness.
"Do you mean it?"
"Of course."
"You've taken a huge weight off my mind, because just remembering my own father and thinking that I might end up being like him makes me want to get sterilised."
"Don't worry, Fermin. Besides, there's probably no treatment capable of crushing your procreative powers."
"Good point," he reflected. "Go on, go and get some sleep. I mustn't keep you any longer."
"You're not keeping me, Fermin. I have a feeling I'm not going to sleep a wink."
"Take a pain for a pleasure. By the way, remember you mentioned that P.O. box? Have you discovered anything?" "I told you to leave it to me. This lunchtime I went up to the post office and had a word
with an old acquaintance of mine who works there. P.O. Box 2321 is registered under the name of one José María Requejo, a lawyer with offices on Calle León the 13th. I took the liberty of checking out the address and wasn't surprised to discover that it doesn't exist. Although I imagine you already know that. Someone has been collecting the letters addressed to that box for years. I know, because some of the mail received from a property business comes as registered post and requires a signature on a small receipt and proof of identification. Who is it? One of Requejo's employees, I asked. I couldn't get that far, but I doubt it. Either I'm very mistaken or this Requejo guy exists on the same plane as Our Lady of Fatima. All I can tell you is the name of the person who collects the mail. Nuria Monfort. I felt the blood draining from me. Nuria Monfort? Are you sure, Fermin? I saw some of those receipts myself. That name and the number of her identity card were on all of them. I deduce from that sick look on your face that this revelation surprises you. Quite a lot. May I ask you who this Nuria Monfort is? The clerk I spoke to told me he remembered her clearly because she went there 2 weeks ago to collect the mail and, in his impartial opinion, she looked hotter than the Venus de Milo, and with a firmer bust. I trust his assessment, because before the war, he was a professor of aesthetics. But he was also a distant cousin of a socialist leader, Largo Caballero, so naturally he now licks one peseta stamps. I was with that woman today, in her home, I murmured. Fermin looked at me in amazement. With Nuria Monfort? I'm beginning to think I was wrong about you, Daniel. You've become quite a rake. It's not what you think, Fermin. That's your loss, then. At your age, I was like El Molino Music Hall. Shows morning, afternoon and night. I gazed at that small, gaunt and bony man with his large nose and his yellow skin, and I realised he was becoming my best friend. May I tell you something, Fermin? Something that's been on my mind for some time. But of course, anything, especially if it's shocking and concerns this yummy maiden. For the second time that night, I began to tell the story of Julian Carax and the enigma of his death. Fermin listened very attentively, writing things down in a notebook and interrupting me every now and then to ask me some detail whose relevance escaped me. Listening to myself, it became increasingly clear to me that there were many lacunae in that story. More than once my mind went blank and my thoughts became lost as I tried to work out why Nuria Monfort would have lied to me. What was the significance of all this? Why had she for years been collecting the mail directed for a non-existent lawyer's office that was supposedly in charge of the Fortuny Carrick's apartment in Ronda de San Antonio? I didn't realise I was voicing my doubts out loud. We can't yet know why that woman was lying to you, said Fermin. But we can speculate that if she did so in this respect, she may have done so, and probably did, in many others. I sighed, completely lost. What do you suggest, Fermin? Fermin Romero de Torres sighed and put on his most Socratic expression. I'll tell you what we can do. This coming Sunday, if you agree, we'll drop by San Gabriel's school quite casually, and we'll make some inquiries concerning the origins of the friendship between this Carax fellow and the other lad, the rich boy. Aldaya. I have a way with priests, you'll see. Even if it's just because I look like a roguish monk. I butter them up a little and I get them eating out of my hand. Are you sure? Positive. I guarantee this lot is going to sing like the Montserrat Boys Choir. Chapter 23. I spent the Saturday in a trance, anchored behind the bookshop counter, in the hope of seeing Bea come through the door, as if by magic. Every time the telephone rang, I rushed to answer it, grabbing the receiver from my father or Fermin. Halfway through the afternoon, after about 20 calls from clients and no news from Bea, I began to accept that the world and my miserable existence were coming to an end.
My father had gone out to price a collection of San Gervasio, and Fermín took advantage of the situation to deliver another of his magisterial lectures on the many mysteries of romance.
"Calm down, or you'll grow a stone in your liver," Fermín advised me. "This business of courtship is like a tango, absurd and pure embellishment. But you're the man, and you must take the lead."
It was all beginning to look pretty grim.
The lead? Me? What do you expect? One has to pay some price for being able to piss standing up. But Bea implied that she would get back to me. "You really don't understand women, Daniel. I bet you my Christmas bonus that the little chick is in her house right now, looking languidly out of the window, like the Lady of the Camellias, waiting for you to come and rescue her from that idiot father of hers and drag her into an unstoppable spiral of lust and sin.
Are you sure? It's a mathematical certainty.
What if she's decided she doesn't want to see me again?
Look, Daniel, women, with remarkable exceptions like your neighbour Metheditas, are more intelligent than we are, or at least more honest with themselves about what they do or don't want. Another question is whether they tell you or the world. You're facing the enigma of nature, Daniel. Womankind is an indecipherable maze. If you give her time to think, you're lost. Remember, warm heart, cold mind, the seducer's code.
Fermín was about to detail the particulars and techniques of the art of seduction when the doorbell tinkled and in walked my friend, Tomás Aguilar.
My heart missed a beat. Providence was denying me Bea, but sending me her brother. A fateful herald, I thought. Tomás had a sombre expression and a certain despondent air.
"What a funereal appearance, Don Tomás," Fermín remarked. "You'll accept a small coffee, at least, I hope."
"I wouldn't say no," said Tomás, with his usual reserve.
Fermín served him a cup of the concoction he kept in a thermos. It gave out an odour suspiciously like sherry.
"Is there a problem?" I asked.
Tomás shrugged.
"Nothing new. My father is having one of his days, and I thought it best to get out and breathe some fresh air for a while."
I gulped.
"Why is that?"
"Goodness knows. Last night my sister Bea arrived home very late. My father was waiting up for her, a bit worked up as usual. She refused to say where she'd been or who she'd been with, and my father flew into a rage. He was screaming and yelling until 4 o'clock in the morning, calling her all sorts of names, a tart being the least of them. He swore he was going to send her to a nunnery, and said that if she ever came back pregnant, he was going to kick her out into the goddamn street."
Fermín threw me a look of alarm. Cold beads of sweat were running down my back.
"This morning," Tomás continued, "Bea locked herself up in her room, and she hasn't come out all day. My father has plonked himself in the dining room to read his newspaper and listen to operettas on the radio full blast. During the interval of Luisa Fernanda, I had to go out because I was going crazy."
"Well, your sister was probably out with her fiancé, don't you think?" Fermín needled. "It would be perfectly natural."
I gave Fermín a kick under the counter, which he avoided with feline dexterity.
"Her fiancé is doing his military service," Tomás said. "He doesn't come back on leave for another 2 weeks. Besides, when she goes out with him, she's home by 8 at the latest."
"And you have no idea where she was or who she was with?"
"He's already told you he doesn't, Fermín," I intervened, anxious to change the subject.
"Nor your father?" insisted Fermín, who was thoroughly enjoying himself.
"No, but he's sworn he'll find out and break the guy's legs and his face as soon as he knows who it is."
I felt myself going deathly pale. Fermín offered me a cup of his concoction without asking. I drank it down in one gulp. It tasted like tepid diesel fuel. Tomás watched me but said nothing. A dark, impenetrable look.
"Did you hear that?" Fermín suddenly said. "Sounded like a drum roll for a somersault."
"No."
Yours truly's Rumblings. Look, I'm suddenly terribly hungry. Do you mind if I leave you two alone and run up to the baker's to grab myself a bun? Not to mention the new shop assistant who's just arrived from Reus. She looks so tasty you could eat her. She's called Maria Bertudes, but despite her name, the girl is pure vice. That way, I'll leave you two to talk in peace, eh? In 10 seconds, Fermin had done a disappearing act, off for his snack and his meeting with a young woman. Tomas and I were left alone, enveloped in a silence as weighty as the Swiss franc. After several minutes, I could bear it no longer. Tomas, I began, my mouth dry. Last night, your sister was with me. He stared at me without even blinking. I swallowed hard. Say something, I said. You're not right in the head. A minute went by, muffled sounds coming in from the street. Tomas held his coffee, which he had not touched. Are you serious? He asked. I've only seen her once. That's not an answer. Do you mind? He shrugged his shoulders. You'd better be sure you know what you're doing. Would you stop seeing her just because I asked you to? Yes, I lied. But don't ask me to. Tomas looked down. You don't know Bea, he murmured. I didn't reply. We let another few minutes go by without saying a word, looking at the grey figures who were scanning the shop window, praying that one of them would decide to come in and rescue us from that poisonous silence. After a while, Tomas abandoned his cup on the counter and made his way to the door. You're leaving already? He nodded. Shall we meet up tomorrow for a while? I said. We could go to the cinema with Fermin, like before. He stopped by the door. I'll only tell you once, Daniel. Don't hurt my sister. On his way out, he passed Fermin, who was returning laden with a bag full of steaming hot buns. Fermin saw him go off into the dusk, shaking his head. He left the buns on the counter and offered me an ensaimada, just out of the oven. I declined. I wouldn't even have been able to swallow an aspirin. You'll get over it, Daniel, you'll see. These things are common between friends. I don't know, I mumbled. Chapter 24. Fermin and I met on Sunday at 7:30 in the morning at the Canaletas Café. Fermin treated me to a coffee and brioche, whose texture, even with butter spread on them, bore a resemblance to pumice stone. We were served by a waiter who sported a fascist badge on his lapel and a pencil moustache. He didn't stop humming to himself, and when we asked him the reason for his excellent mood, he explained that he'd become a father the day before. We congratulated him, and he insisted on giving us each a cigar to smoke during the day in honour of his firstborn. We said we would. Fermin kept looking at him out of the corner of his eye, frowning, and I suspected he was plotting something. Over breakfast, Fermin kicked off the day's investigations with a general outline of the mystery. It all begins with a sincere friendship between two boys, Julian Carax and Jorge Aldaya, classmates since early childhood. Like Don Tomas and yourself. For years all is well. Inseparable friends with a whole life before them, the works. And yet at some point a conflict arises that ruins this friendship. To paraphrase the drawing room dramatists, the conflict bears a woman's name, Penelope. Very Homeric. Do you follow me? The only thing that came to my mind was the last sentence spoken by Tomas the previous evening in the bookshop. Don't hurt my sister. I felt nauseous. In 1919, Julian Carax sets off for Paris, Odysseus fashion. Fermin continued. The letter signed by Penelope, which he never receives, establishes that by then the young woman has been incarcerated in her own house, a prisoner of her family for reasons that are unclear, and that the friendship between Aldaya and Carax has ended.
Moreover, according to Penelope, her brother, Jorge, has sworn that if he ever sees his old friend Julian again, he'll kill him. Grim words indeed. One doesn't have to be Pasteur to deduce that this conflict is a direct consequence of the relationship between Penelope and Carax.
A cold sweat covered my forehead. I could feel the coffee and the few mouthfuls of brioche I'd swallowed rising up my throat.
All the same, we must assume that Carax never gets to know what happened to Penelope because the letter doesn't reach him. He vanishes from sight into the mists of Paris, where he will lead a ghostly existence between his job as a pianist in a variety club and his disastrous career as a remarkably unsuccessful novelist. These years in Paris are a puzzle. All that remains of them today is a forgotten literary work that has virtually disappeared. We know that at some point he decides to marry a mysterious rich lady who is twice his age. The nature of such a marriage, if we are to go by what the witnesses say, seems more an act of charity or friendship on behalf of an ailing lady than a love match. Whichever way you look at it, this patron of the arts, fearing for the financial future of her protégé, decides to leave him her fortune and bid farewell to this world with a roll in the hay to further her noble cause. Parisians are like that.
Perhaps it was a genuine love, I suggested in a tiny voice.
Hey, Daniel, are you all right? You're looking very pale and you're perspiring terribly.
I'm fine, I lied.
As I was saying, love is a lot like pork. There's loin steak and there's bologna. Each has its own place and function. Carax had declared that he didn't feel worthy of any love, and indeed, as far as we know, no romances were recorded during his years in Paris. Of course, working in a brothel, perhaps his basic urges were satisfied by fraternising with the employees, as if it were a perk of the job, so to speak. But this is pure speculation. Let us return to the moment when the marriage between Carax and his protectress is announced. That is when Jorge Aldaya reappears on the map of this murky business. We know he makes contact with Carax's publisher in Barcelona to find out the whereabouts of the novelist. Shortly afterwards, on the morning of his wedding day, Julian Carax fights a duel with an unknown person in Père Lachaise Cemetery and disappears. The wedding never takes place. From then on, everything becomes confused.
Fermín allowed for a dramatic pause, giving me his conspiratorial look.
Supposedly, Carax crosses the border and, with yet another show of his proverbial sense of timing, returns to Barcelona in 1936, at the very outbreak of the Civil War. His activities and whereabouts in Barcelona during these weeks are hazy. We suppose he stays in the city for about a month, and that during this time he doesn't contact any of his acquaintances, neither his father nor his friend, Núria Montfort. Then he is found dead in the street, struck down by a bullet. It is not long before a sinister character makes his appearance on the scene. He calls himself Laïn Coubert, a name he borrows from the last novel by Julian Carax, and who, to cap it all, is none other than the Prince of Darkness. The supposed Lucifer states that he is prepared to obliterate what little is left of Carax and destroy his books forever. To round off the melodrama, he appears as a faceless man disfigured by fire. A rogue from a Gothic operetta in whom, just to confuse matters more, Núria Montfort believes she recognises the voice of Jorge Aldaya.
Let me remind you that Núria Montfort lied to me, I said.
True, but even if Núria Montfort lied to you, she might have done it more by omission and perhaps to dissociate herself from the facts. There are few reasons for telling the truth, but for lying, the number is infinite. Listen, are you sure you're all right? Your face is the colour of goat cheese.
I shook my head and dashed to the toilet. I threw up my breakfast, my dinner, and a good amount of the anger I was carrying with me. I washed my face with freezing water from the sink and looked at my reflection in the blurry mirror on which someone had scrawled "shithead fascists" with a wax crayon. When I got back to the table, I realised that Fermín was at the bar, paying the bill and discussing football with a waiter who had served us.
Better?
He asked. I nodded.
That was a drop in your blood pressure, said Fermin. Here, have a sugar sweet. They cure everything.
On the way out of the café, Fermin insisted that we should take a taxi as far as San Gabriel's school and leave the subway for another day, arguing that the morning was as bright as a political mural and the tunnels were for rats.
A taxi up to Sarriá will cost a fortune, I protested.
The ride's on the Cretins Savings Bank, Fermin put in quickly. The proud patriot back there gave me the wrong change, and we're in business. And you're not up to travelling underground.
Equipped with our ill-gotten funds, we positioned ourselves on a corner at the foot of the Rambla de Catalunya and waited for a cab. We had to let a few go by because Fermin stated that, since he so rarely travelled by car, he wanted to get into a Studebaker at the very least. It took us a quarter of an hour to find a vehicle to his liking, which Fermin hailed by waving his arms about like a windmill. Fermin insisted on travelling in the front seat, and this gave him the chance to get involved in a discussion with the driver about Joseph Stalin, who was the driver's idol and spiritual guide.
There have been three great figures this century. La Passionaria, bullfighter extraordinaire Moronetti, and Joseph Stalin,
the taxi driver proclaimed, getting ready to unload upon us a life of the saintly comrade. I was riding comfortably in the back seat, paying little attention to the tedious speech, with a window open and enjoying the fresh air. Delighted to be driving around in a Studebaker, Fermin encouraged the cab driver's chatter, occasionally punctuating his emotive biography of the Soviet leader with matters of doubtful historic interest.
I've heard he's been suffering badly from prostate trouble ever since he swallowed the pip of a loquat, and now he can only pee if someone hums the Internationale for him, he put in.
Fascist propaganda, the taxi driver explained, more devout than ever. The comrade pisses like a bull. The vulgar might envy such a flow.
This high-level political debate accompanied us as we made our way along Via Augusta towards the hills. Day was breaking with a fresh breeze, and the sky was an intense blue. When we reached Calle Grand Auxerre, the driver turned right and we began the slow ascent towards Paseo de la Bonanova. San Gabriel's school, its red brick facade, dotted with dagger-shaped windows, stood in the middle of a grove at the top of a narrow winding street that led up from the boulevard. The whole structure, crowned by arches and towers, peered over a group of plane trees like some Gothic cathedral. We got out of the taxi and entered a leafy garden strewn with fountains that were adorned with mould-covered angels. Here and there, cobbled paths meandered between the trees. On our way to the main door, Fermin gave me the background on the institution.
Even though it may look like Rasputin's mausoleum to you, San Gabriel's school was, in its day, one of the most prestigious and exclusive institutions in Barcelona. During the Republic, it went downhill because the nouveau riche of the time, the new industrialists and bankers, to whose children it had for years refused access because their surnames smelled too new, decided to create their own schools, where they would be treated with due reverence and where they, in turn, could refuse access to the sons of others. Money is like any other virus. Once it has rotted the soul of the person who houses it, it sets off in search of new blood. In this world, a surname is less durable than a sugared almond. In its heyday, say between 1880 and 1930, more or less, San Gabriel School took in the flower of old established families with bulging wallets. The Aldayers and company came to this sinister establishment as boarders, to fraternise with their equals, go to mass, and learn their history in order to be able to repeat it ad nauseam. But Julian Carax wasn't really one of them, I observed. Sometimes these illustrious institutions offer a scholarship or two for the sons of the gardener or the shoeshine man, just to show their magnanimity and Christian charity, Fermin proffered. The most efficient way of rendering the poor harmless is to teach them to want to imitate the rich. That is the poison with which capitalism blinds the...
Please don't get carried away with social doctrine, Fermin. If one of these priests hears you, they'll kick us out of here.
I realised that a couple of padres were watching us with a mixture of curiosity and concern from the top of the steps that led up to the front door of the school. I wondered whether they'd heard any of our conversation. One of them moved forward with a courteous smile, his hands crossed over his chest like a bishop. He must have been in his early 50s, and his lean build and sparse hair lent him the air of a bird of prey. He had a penetrating gaze, and gave off an aroma of fresh eau de cologne and mothballs.
"Good morning. I'm Father Fernando Ramos," he announced. "How can I help you?"
Fermin held out his hand. The priest examined it briefly before shaking it, giving us an icy smile.
"Fermin Romero de Torres, bibliographic advisor to Semperi and Son. It is an enormous pleasure to greet you, your most devout excellency. Here at my side, my collaborator and friend, Daniel, a young man of promise and much recognized Christian qualities."
Father Fernando observed us without blinking. I wanted the earth to swallow me.
"The pleasure is all mine, Signor Romero de Torres," he replied amicably. "May I ask what brings such a formidable duo to our humble institution?"
I decided to intervene before Fermin made some other outrageous comment, and we had to make a quick exit.
"Father Fernando, we're trying to locate two former alumni of San Gabriel's, Jorge Aldaya and Julian Carax."
Father Fernando pursed his lips and raised an eyebrow.
"Julian died over 15 years ago, and Aldaya went off to Argentina," he said dryly. "Did you know them?" asked Fermin.
The priest's sharp gaze rested on each of us before he answered.
"We were classmates. May I ask what your interest is in this matter?"
I was wondering how to answer the question, but Fermin beat me to it.
"You see, it so happens that we have in our possession a number of articles that belong or belonged, for on this particular, the legal interpretation leads to confusion, to the two persons in question."
"And what is the nature of these articles, if you don't mind my asking?"
"I beg your grace to accept our silence, for God knows there are abundant reasons for conscience and secrecy that have nothing to do with the unquestioning faith your excellency merits, as does the order which you represent with such measure of gallantry and piety," Fermin spewed out at great speed.
Father Fernando appeared to be almost in shock. I decided to take up the conversation again before Fermin had time to get his breath back.
"The articles Signor Romero de Torres is referring to are of a personal nature, mementos and objects of purely sentimental value. What we would like to ask you, Father, if this isn't too much trouble, is to tell us what you remember about Julian and Aldaya from your days as schoolboys."
Father Fernando was still looking at us suspiciously. It became obvious to me that the explanations we'd given him were not enough to justify our interest and earn us his collaboration. I threw a look of desperation at Fermin, begging him to find some cunning argument with which to win over the priest.
"Do you know that you look a bit like Julian when he was young?" asked Father Fernando suddenly.
Fermin's eyes lit up. "Here he goes," I thought. "All our luck rests on this card."
"Very shrewd of you, Your Reverence," proclaimed Fermin, feigning surprise. "Your uncanny insight has unmasked us. You'll end up as a cardinal, at least, or even a pope."
"What are you talking about?"
Isn't it obvious and patent, Your Lordship?"
"Quite frankly, no."
"Can we count on the secrecy of the confessional?"
"This is a garden, not a confessional."
"It will be enough if you grant us your ecclesiastic discretion."
"You have it."
Fermin heaved a deep sigh and looked at me with a melancholy expression. "Daniel, we can't go on lying to this saintly soldier of Christ."
"Of course not," I corroborated, completely lost.
Fermin went up to the priest and murmured in a confidential tone, "Father, we have most solid grounds to suspect that our friend Daniel here is none other than the secret son of the deceased Julian Carax. Hence our interest in reconstructing the past and recovering the memory of an illustrious person whom the fates tore away from the side of a poor child."
Father Fernando fixed his astounded eyes on me.
Is this true?
I nodded.
Fermin patted my back, his face full of sorrow.
Look at him, poor lad, searching for a father lost in the mist of memory. What could be sadder than this? Tell me, your most saintly grace.
Have you any proof to support your assertions?
Fermin grabbed my chin and offered up my face as payment.
What further proof would the clergyman require than this little face, silent, irrefutable witness of the paternal fact in question?
The priest seemed to hesitate.
Will you help me, Father? I implored cunningly. Please.
Father Fernando sighed uncomfortably.
I don't suppose there's any harm in it, he said at last.
What do you want to know?
Everything, said Fermin.